Good morning. Welcome back to Love Babs Love Talk. I'm Babs Rawls Ivy, and I just finished a wonderful conversation with one of the Yale World Fellows from Haiti, Ralph Francois, and Luino Robillard, who is a community activist from Haiti. So we had a rich conversation. So the second part of my Friday is more talking, and I'm talking to a friend who just wrote a book, co-authored a book, Elisa Kemahort Page, Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Activism, and Advocacy for All. So, hello there.
Oh, hi, Bab. So nice to talk to you.
It is so nice to talk to you, and thank you for hanging with us through our little technical difficulties, because sometimes it's a little challenging when I have guests back to back to back. So I thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So I'm so glad. So my book hasn't come yet. I ordered it, but it hasn't arrived yet, and I couldn't get a copy anywhere, so they're on order. But that's okay, because we're gonna have a great conversation. So I imagine, Elisa, that you wrote this book, you co-authored this book, because there was nothing out there that spoke to this kind of work.
Well, something like that, yes, because really this wasn't the book I had planned to write. A week before the 2016 election, I had been working with the company I was working with to create an exit plan because I had other projects I wanted to work on, and I was thinking about writing a book, but, you know, a businessy book about what I had been doing. And that's because I assumed I knew what kind of world we would be living in after the following week in Election Day. The very day after the election, one of my co-authors, Carolyn Gerin, texted me to see how I was doing. And she said, you know, I have a vision of what I need to do. And I need to create a guidebook for just regular people who aren't activists, who are going to get fired up and also going to want to protect their democracy and protect the things they care about, because who knows what's going to happen over the next few years. And are you interested in working on it with me? And I definitely was. And I invited our third co-author, Jamia Wilson, to join us just so we'd have a broader perspective, different expertise, different networks. And the idea really was that I was seeing people all around me who had never been political were going on marches and joining organizations and calling their congresspeople and writing letters. And they were fired up in a way I had never seen. And I don't want it to fall back, you know, even if over the next, you know, we had a blue wave here in the midterms, even if over the next 2 years more things change and people feel more comfortable that we're getting back to a government that they kind of recognize, I want to give people the way to keep being as involved and engaged and activated. But I was concerned that people couldn't keep up the level of intensity and it's exhausting, right?
It is.
People I know are just exhausted. So I'm like, how can we create a way to sort of manage this and to create a guidebook to how to have, well, what I call work-life activism balance forever, not just for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I find this fascinating and interesting that people, certainly in my lifetime, are so excited and wanting to sort of get in community and do this work. Not even knowing how to do the work, just like, I know I have
Correct.
To go and align myself with somebody, with something. And I mean, we've seen movements created. We've seen Black Lives Matter. We've seen pink hats. We've seen, you know, women's organization. We've seen black women. We've seen all kinds of things. And people are truly, truly affected by this last presidential election. And I Right. think it was like a shake up, a wake up, I would say, a wake up. So
yeah, definitely. And I also observed during the campaign that a lot of people, you know, they've been checking the box of voting. Not everybody, but a lot of people voted, and that was their civic duty. But they didn't really follow how things happen. If you care about government, how does it really work? How does mm-hmm. politics really work? How does government really work? Didn't know how to, you know, if you want to get something done, where do you even start?
Mm-hmm.
And I also felt like over the time we were writing the book, that people are so focused on Washington, D.C. and President Trump. But, you know, there's a lot of things happening right in your own backyard. And by the time something reaches Washington, D.C., it has bubbled up. I believe our culture drives what happens there. I don't believe what's happening there is driving our culture. Yes, I think that what happens there is emboldening and sort of highlighting different things and making people feel they have permission for certain behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't by accident that President Trump was elected. And you can start at your local level and your state level to start right where you are and
yes,
the changes that you want to see. And that will ladder up.
As an old politician, I tell people all politics is local. I mean, it starts right mm-hmm. at your school board level. It starts at, I mean, it starts
yep.
starts early, right? So I know you at least 10, 15 years back. I met you at Blogger San Francisco. I think mm-hmm. it was like, I want to say like 09 or maybe 07.
08.
08. Oh. 08. Now you.
You tell me a city or, and I can tell me a year and I can tell you what city we were in. You tell me a city and I can tell you what year it was.
Oh my God. That is good. So you are a founding member of Blogger, and you and your two other, founders, Jory and Lisa, right? Founded this.
Yeah.
I guess this was the beginning of blogging and social media kinds of things, and everybody was doing this, communicating and creating communities, and you all saw opportunities sort of to step into that and provide leadership and substance and a place where bloggers could converse and connect. At least that's how I understand it. So you don't come
well,
to...
You know, it's interesting because it's a little more, really from the beginning, is a little more politically in the small p, you know, kind of generally political mission there, because in late 2004, blogging was still pretty new and just coming into the mainstream. And what we kind of observed is that when media would cover the space or mm-hmm. when they started to look to bloggers to be sources, what we saw is the only blogs that seemed to exist in the eyes of the more mainstream were, you guessed it, by white men.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt like it just would be a shame if we replicated the same homogenous old boys network in this new democratized media form, that would be a horrible shame. And so Lisa Stone and Joy Desjardins and I first came together to produce the first blogger conference before we were even a company. We just did it as a labor of love. We put our credit cards down and put out a call and said, who's interested in this? Because we wanted to make a statement about, you know, you are not going to pretend that there are not tons of women and all kinds of women who are in the space, who are creating content, who are experts in different topics. We're not going to let that happen. And so after that first conference, then we said, oh, you know what? There's a business opportunity here because there's a community here and they want things. They want exposure for their work. They want the opportunity to make money for, you know, get paid for doing what they were good at and what they love to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to come together and have community. So we formed the company after the first conference. And the mission always was to create opportunities for the women in our network to, you know, pursue whether it was community or economic empowerment, really, and exposure for their work.
So you do that. You all create this. It's massively successful. People are connected. I mean, I've made friends from the very first time I went to San Francisco who are still my friends. Who I visit, who I see,
yeah.
who I connect with, who I talk to on a regular basis. So there's that. And then you all make the decision to sort of move on to other projects, and Blog Her becomes part of a larger entity. I think I'm saying this right.
You know, that happened over many years. So we founded it in 2005, and for 2 years we bootstrapped it. We just got by on revenue. I went through my life savings and took out $50,000 in debt because I wasn't pulling a salary. And so in 2007, we realized that other women's media companies, traditional media companies, were starting to recognize the power of women content creators and influencers and women as consumers they already knew about. And we began to realize that they had deep pockets to try to build, you know, to try to pay to build what we had built from organic community development. So that's when we decided we needed to scale more quickly than we had been. We went and got venture funding. You know, when you look at venture capital, the quantity of startups founded by all-female founding teams that get venture capital is less than 3% mm-hmm. of the startups that get funding. So, but we went out and we raised over time 4 rounds of funding, and that took us all the way up to 2014. So we had been at it. We were approaching our 10th year. And, you know, the media business, as you well know, being in the media business, is pretty dynamic and some might say volatile there. And there's been so much innovation over those years. You know, when we started, there was no social media. There was no Twitter. Facebook was for college students. YouTube was founded after we were founded. So we had to constantly adjust. But also, there was no smartphone when we started.
Wow.
So people's behaviors, yeah, I mean, the iPhone came out in 07, 2 years after we were in business. And so people's behaviors changed so dramatically. We were constantly adapting and reinvesting and reinventing. And after almost 10 years, you know, when we felt like that was a thing that was happening again, especially with digital video, we were like, maybe it's time to join forces with a bigger company that's already invested in video and has the resources, because we were still pretty, you know, scrappy at that point. And so that's when we joined forces with She Knows Media. And I stayed there for another almost 2.5 years, maybe more than 2.5 years, actually. And but yeah, after a while, you know, it begins to be like, okay, what else can I be doing? And, you know, I'm still answering the question. I said to somebody yesterday that, you know, I was trying to figure out what to do over these last year and a half, what I want to be when I grow up again. Oh, and by the way, I wrote this book. And they're like, well, it sounds like you've been doing things. And I'm like, yes, but I'm still figuring it out even so.
Mm-hmm. So this book comes at a good time because it's certainly, I mean, you certainly have a good grasp of what is going on politically around this country. And you all saw a need in helping people sort of manage their anxiety around what can they do? What can they do at the grassroots level? Yeah. And give them a sense of, okay, if I read this book, if I have this book, it'll give me a sense of structure so that I'm not just willy-nilly out there running from one cause to another cause to a, you know how people will do. So,
yeah.
So I'm interested.
Well, there's a couple of things. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
There's a couple of things. And the first was we really wanted to point out how many other institutions affect your life every single day that mm-hmm. aren't Washington, D.C. And that includes the company you work for and the school that you either go to or your kids go to and the media that you're consuming and the healthcare system and, of course, your local government and county and state government. So, you know, we were trying to widen people's lens on what they could activate around. We tried to provide, you know, resources to figure out how to get in and get started. And the main thing I talk to people about now that these 2 years have gone by and people have been going full throttle, you know, I'm upset about 25 different issues every day. I mean, you see my Facebook ads. I'm upset about a lot.
I'm right there with you. All day, every day.
All day, every day. And I can be upset like that, but I can't be an effective activist trying to focus on 25 issues.
Right.
That's just really, you know, it's not possible. So when I'm out here talking to people about the book, I'm really encouraging people to triage your passions and really figure out what are the couple of issues you are ride or die for, this year, next year, 5 years from now. And it doesn't mean that you can't pick up the phone and call your congressperson when they're about to get rid of net neutrality, or it doesn't mean that you can't do a little text banking for, you know, campaigns outside your area or all those things when you can. But when it comes to digging deeper and really looking to make impact, triage your issues. Triage your issues. Figure out how you can contribute, what's needed, and how you can apply your skills. We, you know, movements meet people with different kinds of skills. Not everyone has to tie themselves to a tree. Some people are going to babysit for the people who tie themselves to the tree. And some, you know, organizations need accountants to volunteer their skills, or marketers. They need your old technology. If you have a technology graveyard in your office, you know, there are organizations out there who would love a five-year-old phone or computer. And so figure out what your assets are, what your skills are, and how you can apply them. And the third thing, and I really got this from Patrice Cullors, who's one of the founders of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. She was like, you know, I really would prefer, I think it's more effective when people figure out who's doing the work and try to join up and aggregate with them rather than flailing around on their own. And I always say, who, if you pick your ride or die issues, who are the organizations, what are the organizations that are already doing great work there, and how can you help them and amplify them? And particularly, if you want to be an ally, which are the organizations that are run by the people you say you want to be an ally with?
Mm-hmm.
So Black Lives Matter is a great example. You want to work for racial, you know, to move towards racial justice, then work with an organization that is founded and led by Black people. You know, that's instead of trying to white savior it, you know, so join up. And then the last thing I always tell people is track your wins. I mean, take a moment and know the things, the bad things we prevented from happening, the good things we helped to make happen. You can't feel like it's a futile job. You have to take that moment, because it can be really depressing if all you focus on is how much is left to change. You know, it's really hard to stay energized and motivated. So take a moment and track your wins too.
I think you make those are very good points, because I'm always telling people, get with an organization that's already doing the stuff that you want to be doing, and and join up and help that, instead of trying to figure out, you know, willy nilly out there trying to organize against the grain when something is already, you know, in place. I mean, if you care about women's reproductive rights, then get yourself over to Planned Parenthood and volunteer and help raise money so they can continue the work that they do. If you care about racial justice kinds of things, then, you know, Black Lives Matter and Brian Stevenson's organization. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things out there. Like, people don't have to recreate a wheel. They can.
Correct.
So, Alisa, do you feel political? Do you feel like a political person?
Do I feel like a political person?
Because this is what I always, when I talk to people sometimes, this is what they'll say. Well, you know, I'm not political. And I'm like, no, you are political, because politics happens all around you all the time.
Yes. So a personal, I think Gloria Steinem may be the correct attribution for that famous phrase, you know, the personal is political.
Yes.
Everything ultimately is political, because everything in this country, someone's making a decision somewhere. If deciding how many, deciding whether the police in your area have implicit bias training is happening at the municipal and the county level. Deciding how much low and no income housing is going to be available to try and address the homeless problem, that's happening at your city and local level. Deciding what the dress code is at your school and whether it is inherently biased against particularly girls and girls of color, that's happening at either the administration or the school board level. Like, all of these things are happening right around you. People who are your neighbors are making decisions that affect your life, and some about very personal things like what you can wear and where you can live and what you can do in your own backyard. So
what you decide to call yourself.
Yeah.
And how do you identify, right?
Exactly. Like, they're trying to tell you who you can be, not just what you can do and can't do, but who you can actually be in the world. And that is highly personal, and it has become political. And And the thing is, you may live, I get this, what I get a lot, and I don't know if you get it, you're in Connecticut, right?
So mm-hmm.
I get a lot, oh, my congressman, I live in a bubble, my congressman, I already agree with them, like, why should I call my congressperson, or what can I do? I'm in a safe state, for whatever their point of view is, you know. And the fact is that, A, your congressman still, or congresswoman still, wants to hear from people because it's the direction of the contact that they're getting. How many people are calling them about healthcare versus calling them about immigration versus calling them about net neutrality? It tells them about the priorities of their constituents. And politics is a compromise game. It is a trade-off game. And every politician needs to know what are the things they're working with when it comes to negotiating. So even if your congressperson agrees with you on an issue, they may not, you know, they may not push as hard as you want if they're not hearing from their constituents. So even if you live in a place you consider safely, you know, if you're in a blue bubble or a red bubble, you know, it's still, there's stuff happening, there's trade-offs being made, and they're doing it based on what their constituents, how their constituents express themselves.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like there's a run for office in your future?
You know what? I would really like to, and I talk a lot when I go out on the road with the book, I talk a lot about commissions, and I know you've served on some. So mm-hmm. most counties, cities and counties have commissions and committees that are appointed and not elected,
mm-hmm.
and they're about every topic under the sun, mm-hmm. and you can go find one that aligns with one of your ride or die issues. And start attending their meetings. And those are, you know, for a lot of those commissions and committees, they're working committees. They do real stuff. And I definitely would like to do something like that. But I'll tell you, running for office, there's two things. You spend a lot of time raising money,
mm-hmm.
which is inevitable and unavoidable.
Yep.
But the other thing is, I may be wrong, but I perceive it to be a pretty extroverted activity. Like I have friends who have run for local office, and they talk about, they go out every weekend and they're knocking on doors and making all those phone calls. And that really you know, is daunting to me. And then the third thing is, I feel like I've been pretty mouthy on the internet for more than 10 years. And I can just imagine the things they would find. I mean, how much I curse, or how much I, you know, how, strongly I word things. I feel like I haven't behaved on the internet like I wanted to run for office. I'll just put it that way.
That's it. Now that's very thoughtful. That is quite thoughtful. I don't think I've ever heard anybody sort of put it that way. But that's quite thoughtful. And
oh, really?
And I would suggest that all those things would make you an ideal candidate, because this is the age that we're living in. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that politicians who are willing to be strongly pro or strongly con things are appealing to people right now. I think that's, I mean, as much as I hate to put my brain, I hate to get in the mind space of a Trump supporter, to be honest, but I think that one of the things you hear repeatedly about what's appealing about it is that whole, oh, he what's it? He says what he thinks.
Which is,
you know, he tells it like it is.
Yeah.
Which I think is like, I think considering how dishonest he is most of the time, it's just a very ironic thing to say you like about him, but that's just me. But that is the thing that people like gravitate to, like they're tired. And that has a real, in his case, I think it's had this really negative impact in that I think that although I think he's the logical conclusion of decades of Republican strategy and policymaking, he's saying out loud what was at the heart of so much strategy and policy making, and he's making people feel they don't have to be embarrassed at what's at the heart of why they believe in those policies.
Exactly.
And strategies.
Yeah.
And they like that. They like, and they probably all these years have felt like all those other GOP politicians were beating around the bush and not really coming out and just quote unquote telling it like it is, and because they were being politic. You know, and sort of trying to hedge their bets a little bit. And he is not a hedge your bet kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. So when you all co-wrote this book, co-authored this book, now that it's done and you're out speaking about it, has it satisfied its intent for you? Do you feel like...
Do you know what I mean? I feel like... No, I feel like what I walk away with when I do an event with people is I walk away with people telling me they feel like they can go on and they feel like they have some hope and they feel like they have some direction. And so that's serving the intent. And I'll tell you, I did an event in Portland a while back, and it was a very small event with sex workers. And these are people who feel it's very hard for them to speak out. It's very hard for them to be public, but they have many policy issues that they care very deeply about. And so trying to help them figure out ways that they can activate at a local level that's both protective for them, but also can be effective for them. You know, it was a really gratifying evening where a lot of them were like, they were just thinking anew about their own power and their own voice and how they could use it. And I'm really, you know, I'm really here for that. I'm really here for people knowing that they, at the end, it's us, right? And that's why I say that what happens in Washington comes out of our culture. At the end, it really is us. It's us, whether we're staying home and not voting. It's us, whether we're, you know, no matter how we're voting. And it's us who can protect the vote for the people who are being disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my ride or die issues, is I feel like we, if we protected the vote, we would be in a lot better position as a country. And that's on us as well, because that happens. If you're worried about gerrymandering or voter suppression or voter restriction, that all happens at the state level. That's happening right where you live.
Yes.
It's not a federal, you know, yes, the Voting Rights Act was gutted and that affects a number of states, but there's stuff happening all over this country that has nothing to do with the Voting Rights Act and everything to do with state politics. So, you know, get to know who your state representatives are and get to know what your state's laws are about voting and who they're designed to restrict.
I will tell you, Lisa, it is a different day. I remember when Lonnie Guinier first raised this issue of gerrymandering and how people just dragged her like as if she was some kind of common criminal or something. And now we're fast forward 20 years, almost 30 years, and gerrymandering is part of our lexicon now. Like, people can rattle it off without, you know, whispering it, right? Like, we know what it is and we understand it. So, you know, how far we've come understanding just that that language around, that language and actions around gerrymandering and what that looks like and what that means for communities. So, do you think the book will have a life of its own and cause you all to sort of create opportunities to train people? As you know,
that's so interesting to bring that up. Yeah, we're talking about that right now, about taking these steps. You know, I was talking about triage your skills, triage your passions, identify your skills, join up with others, and track your progress. Like, this is kind of a rubric for making your roadmap. And so we're talking right now about, like, how do we turn that into something where we can actually work with people right there and help them build their personal roadmap.
Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty powerful, because I think, you know, I've introduced you to my good friend Patty Russo, who is the executive director of the Yale Campaign School for Women, which I came through in my early political life. And what they do is they train women how to run for office, partisan, Republicans and Democrats or independents, whoever wants to run for office. So they train people, and they train people, if you don't want to run for office, you want to be a campaign manager. You want to learn how to run campaigns and that kind of thing. But I don't see anything that sort of really does this, create a roadmap for activism for yourself and what that would look like. So that's why I raised that question, because I think that's the next level of service, commitment to service, and coaching, right? Like, that's to me, that makes sense. It seems like the next level. It's no more about it's about, okay, how can I serve from where I'm at.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like so many more people have been awakened to that. And, you know, we interview in the book. The book has some guidelines and checklists and resources and all sorts of really handy-dandy, snackable, digestible chunks. But we also interview a bunch of people who are doing the work, mm-hmm. and how they did the work, and from all different kinds of things they're doing, from local politicians to people who started nonprofits to people who are just out there activating in their community. And the thing is, you know, they all were just regular people trying to get by who saw something that they couldn't let go and that they wanted to do more for. And I also just do want to point out that, you know, if you are researching for groups who are doing what you care about and you don't find what you need, it is okay to make your own. And I love the example, and she's out from your area, which is why I wanted to bring her up. Amber Goodwin,
mm-hmm.
Is a young woman. She cares a lot about gun safety, but when she looked at after Sandy Hook, and she looked at all the organizations that were starting to be created, and these organizations are incredibly effective. Moms Demand Action, Every Town for Gun Safety,
mm-hmm.
Now the Parkland Survivors. I mean, they're doing some amazing work. But a few years ago, she was like, I don't see anyone focusing on my community of people of color, and the kind of gun violence that we experience
on a regular daily basis.
Yeah. And she looked and she tried to find someone to coalesce with and didn't find it. And so she created her Community Justice Reform Coalition. And it's an organization focused on gun safety, but focused in communities of color. And that is, I just wanted to make sure to say that is okay to do if you can't find what you need and you've researched it. And then I think there's something so powerful about organizations with different angles coming together when they need to, and coalescing as an aggregating organizations, not just individuals.
Yeah.
And you see that in the reproductive rights movement, because Planned Parenthood, to your point, they're focused on like delivering the actual service and healthcare, but they probably couldn't do the work they do as well as they do if they didn't have NARAL that's focused on electing pro-choice politicians, and the Center for Reproductive Rights that's focused on going to court and litigating over policy and litigating over these restrictive laws that various states try to pass. So I really think of that as the three-legged stool of reproductive rights organizations and support, and they find where they can be of the most use, where they can serve. And they serve.
I think that's a good point, Elisa. And I think this climate, more so than any other time that I've ever seen, and I'm 55 years old, that I'm seeing organizations connect to other organizations with not so much like-minded missions, but that they need the strength of each other. So I'm starting to see people sort of come together. I'm seeing it around... people are starting to look at like hyper mass incarceration as something that affects entire communities and everything. Like it touches every facet of lives rather than this small population where, you know, all it's about is lockup and reentry. It's so much more than that. And so you're starting to see these connections and collaborations around different community groups joining in these efforts. So to your point, I mean, this is the time where people figure out they need each other.
Yes. And, you know, eventually I hope that we all see how interwoven, really, if I think about what's the overriding issue that I care about, and I can put it in one word, and it's justice.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these justice issues are tied together. Racial justice and LGBTQ justice and gender justice and food justice and environmental justice and all of these things going on, socioeconomic justice, all of these things, to use the well-worn word, are intersectional. They all work together. You almost can't have one without the other, because if you leave anyone behind, then you don't really have true justice. And so ultimately, I see so many organizations, they're focusing on their angle of the justice issue, but they're all driving towards the same future you know, where hopefully we have a more just society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to your credit, I will say this, that you are much more than an ally. You are definitely an accomplice to women of color, because I've heard you and I've seen you talk about when you are invited to speak on boards, or when you're invited to be at conferences or whatever, and you look over the biographies and you don't see any women of color, and you're like, I don't see any women of color, and you say that out loud, and you go to them with that, I don't see any women of color here.
We can all identify. That's something I don't feel introverted about, which is, you know, when someone's trying to get me to give them my money for something, then I'm a customer and I want to tell them what I would need to want to give them money, and I would need to see inclusion, you know, and they don't have it, you know, and they should know. They should know why they're not getting my money. So I often will write back, and I'm sure they don't expect it, you know, to get these kind of emails, because they're just sending me their standard marketing. Hey, come to this conference, come to that conference. And they'll get this little rant back from me. But you know what? I don't try to just rant. I actually usually try to say, do you need some introductions? Like, I know a lot of people. I've hired hundreds of speakers over the years through Blogger. So, and you know, it is sadly rare how often they want to take me up on that kind of offer. But, you know, we just got to one email at a time, got to try and change their perspective, I guess.
But I think the fact that you raise it and the fact that they receive it, no, whatever they do with that, that's one thing.
Right.
But they can't ever say they never heard it, because you've given it to them. So they can do what they will, but they can't go with that. Oh, I didn't know. No, you do know. Because I told you.
Exactly. But, you know, it's interesting, because, you know, there's so many. I'm here, actually, I'm speaking to you from Palm Springs, because I attended TED Women this week, just as an attendee. And it started on Wednesday. I went to a workshop. I'm going to look up her name so I give her credit. It was about identity and equity and power, and sort of, you know, a lot of the workshop, there were exercises about sort of identifying your own, how you identify what benefits that, what privileges that gives you, and what is not privileged about that. And it was a really interesting exercise. Antoinette Carroll, and she's one of the TED Fellows. And it was very interesting. And, you know, I had some really interesting conversations with people about what it will take to drive more inclusion. And even amongst people who want the same outcome, they don't always agree on the method. Like, I'm like you, Babs, I'm 54. At this point in my life, after this many years as a woman in the world and a woman in business and a woman in tech, I am all about, California just passed a law that requires public companies to have at least one woman on their board. And the bigger the company is, the more women they have to have on their board, or the bigger their board is. And I'm like all about it. Like, it's time for that. Let's go Scandinavian on this issue and make there be boxers to chess. And, you know, I spoke to a young woman of color actually at this workshop who was like, well, I don't know if I just want to be a box check. And I'm like, you know what? We will have achieved equity when there are as many mediocre women and people of color and LGBT people in power as there are mediocre white men. That's like equity, when we can be, when we don't have to be the paragons of excellence in order to advance.
Right.
And I am longing for that day. And I feel like box checking is going to help us get there, because ultimately people will try to find the qualified folks to check those boxes.
Absolutely.
And you need more than one, right? You need several in a room before it changes the dynamic. But to me, that's the only thing. I'm like, that's it. Let's be Scandinavia, you know, and let's make there be, I'm like, quotas, yes. And I know that is, so many people that don't agree with me about that, but I'm like, I've been here a long time and seen everything good intentions has accomplished, and it's not much.
Right.
So now we need a metric, and we need accountability, and we need to just make people do it, and they will whine and struggle and not like it for like 5 years, and then everyone will get used to it, and you know,
I like
fine.
That's some good thinking right there. That is some, and I'm, you know what? I'm going to take this message everywhere I go.
You know, because I'm getting old. I want to see it in my lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been here a while, and I've seen all, you know, I live in Silicon Valley where they talk a game about, you know, doing better on diversity and inclusion, but the numbers don't budge.
Yeah.
And I was saying this on Wednesday, like if Google wanted to hire 100 non-white male engineers tomorrow, they absolutely could. We're not talking about them hiring 1 million. I don't want to hear about the pipeline. I don't want to hear about like, oh, their lower ratio of non-white men in programming. That's true, but there's certainly 100.
Yes.
So go find them.
Yep.
You could do it in a heartbeat.
Yep.
If it was really that important to you to make the change. You know?
That is some good talking right there. So I'm excited to see what you do with this book. I'm excited to see what you all create out of this and how this shapes out, because there is something there and there is a need, and you'll find it. I mean, you will find the niche and it will work and people will flock to it, because you know you have a trusted following, following of folks who know of your authenticity and your integrity. And so we'll follow you and we'll be interested in what you do next. At least I'm one of those people.
When I figure it out, I'll let you know.
I know. I stay tuned because I want to see, because I think this is a great book. I can't wait for mine to come. I've ordered some for presents for people. Particularly around you know, I just flipping through it. I had somebody else's copy. I think it's a good book for young people too. Like, you know, those kids who are about to jump into college or halfway in college and just trying to, you know, figure out what to do and how to be and, you know, those kinds of things. And for people who still like, you know what, I still got a little fight in me. Let me pick this up and see where I could fall in at this point in my life. Right. So I think it's a useful tool for a lot of people on a lot of levels.
Oh, thank you. And I also think it's great for, like, for me, it's a great idea because I do have a lot of people come to me and be like, you know, and they have for the last however many years about, I got to do something about this. I don't know what to do. What should I do? And now I can just say, well, read this book. And now you will have the tools and go out there and like self-educate and self-motivate yourself to get out there and make that difference you want to make. Like, but as long, I really believe when people, if they customize their actions to their own interests and skills and what motivates them and what keeps them pumped up, then you're going to create more sustainability and you're going to create more long-term activists. And that's, you know, that's what's going to save us all.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Elisa Kamahart Page. I've enjoyed you.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed this very much.
Good talking to you.
Yes. So the book is Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Activism, and Advocacy for All. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. And happy holidays.
Thank you,
Beth. I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, happy holidays. Okay.
All right. So that was my friend, Elisa Kamahart Page. Her book, Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Activism, Advocacy for All, is out there in the place where all books are sold, Target, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, get it. And give it as a gift, because I think if you're interested in the way the world works and you want to be in politics and you want to do some advocacy, that is the book for you. So I'm out of here. Stay tuned for Pundits. Thanks for listening to Love Babs Love Talk. I'll be back in the next hour to mix it up politically. Yeah.
Thank you.